I'm pulling out of my driveway. We all know what that means. It's time for their drive to work. Okay, so today I'm going to talk all about flux. What is flux? I will explain. So one of the things about magic that is, it's not unique to magic, but something that magic does that's unlike a lot of games, is that it is constantly changing. It is a game that evolves. And so, for example, I have a thing I call the crispy hash brown theory, which is one of the reasons I think magic is successful. For those who have never heard it, I've told it a few times, but I haven't told it in a while. So when you eat hash browns, the most awesome part of the hash browns is the crispy outside. And at some point, once you eat the crispy outside, well, you eat the inside. And the inside's okay. It's good. But it's not as good as the crispy outside. And in this metaphor, in games, I believe there's a period early in a game of discovery where you're trying to, like, learn and understand the game. That, to me, is the most exciting part of a game. But eventually, what happens is you get past that discovery portion and you start getting into more memorization. If you play Scrabble, for example, you get to a point where you start memorizing 2- and 3-letter words. If you play chess, you have to get to the part where you start memorizing chess openings. That it's less about sort of discovery and more about learning kind of the people that have mastered it. What have they done? And what are the things you have to learn? And that it leaves this discovery phase. And it's not that the mastery phase can't be fun. A lot of people enjoy it. But it's more of like just learning what others before you have learned and just sort of ingraining that. But one of the things that magic does, which is really interesting, is because magic keeps putting out new cards, it keeps evolving. It keeps changing. That a strategy that might have been dominant one month might not be the next month because new cards come out that undermine that strategy. And so the idea is, in this metaphor of hash browns, magic grows back its crispy shell. And that one of the reasons we do a lot of data on magic, and that the average magic player plays magic a pretty long time, especially comparative to most games. Now, part of it is magic has existed a long time. That helps. But in general, because magic keeps reinventing itself, because it keeps changing, that it's not like it gets boring because, you learn something and you figure out some strategy, and then all of a sudden it gets upended. And that this constant flow, this flux of change really is a dynamic part of the game. And in fact, I think it's a big part of the game of why people stick with the game for so long is it is this kind of living, breathing thing. And that's what I want to talk about today, that what exactly is the flux in magic? How does the flux happen? How is it an ever-changing game? And the other thing that my big sort of lesson of today is I think there's a popular belief that sort of R&D was the one that chooses what the game is. And I will say today that it's not true. So I'm going to walk through sort of what we do on the R&D end of things, and then what actually makes the change? How does the game evolve? That is today's topic of flux. Okay, so first and foremost, let me just sort of explain the importance of flux to the game of Magic. When you sit down to play another game, you're playing Monopoly. Okay, let's say I play Monopoly, and I pull the pieces out of my Monopoly board. Well, guess what? They're all the same pieces. The properties are the same. The values are the same. The railroads are the same. And even the stuff that's random, like the chase and the community chess cards, they're the same cards. And so the idea is that it's not that games can't play out differently, because every game has built in it some amount of randomness, I'm going to roll dice in Monopoly. Well, that determines what I land on. And then as the game progresses, different people are going to buy different properties. And so if I own Park Place or Boardwalk, hey, it's not a big deal to land on them. But if my opponent owns them, oh no, that could be super dramatic. And so games are set up such that from game to game, there is, different things can happen. And that's exciting, and that is cool, and that any game has some amount of variance to it. That is fine. Any game, I should take that back. There are some games that have less variance to them, chess being a good example. Now, there is variance to chess. It's a little harder to understand the variance to chess just because chess doesn't have a random element. Like Magic, you shuffle the deck. Monopoly, you roll dice. Scrabble, you pull, you know, letters out of a bag. Like, those have built into them a sort of a random element, meaning that from game to game, you'll have different decisions to make because you have different choices presented to you. Where in a game like chess, the games will be different, but it has to do with choices made by your opponent. And there is some variance in that. For example, if I play chess and I'm good at a particular move, there are things that are good and bad against that move. And if my opponent is proficient in one way to play versus another, that is adding a random element, not quite in the same way of rolling a die, but it is one of the things that can make chess games very different from game to game, both in who you're playing or just what strategy someone's employing. So games do, built into them, have some amount of variance built into them that every time I play a game, you want the experience to be somewhat different. And it varies. There's some games like chess where on some level it's the same pieces every time, and it's just the choice you make with those pieces that make the variance. Where other times, there's actual elements. You have a deck of cards you shuffle. You roll die. You do something in which it gives you some input that varies from game to game. Okay, but Flux goes a little beyond that. That's not really what Flux is. I mean, there is variance in Magic, and like you know, even if you take your deck and play against your friend's deck, and let's even say we're talking like standard 60-card 4-of deck. If you and your friend play with the exact same deck, there still is variance in play just because of the randomization of the cards. Deck A versus deck B, you could play that same match many times, and it's not always identical. Now, there are things that will come out. There are definitely things that will be similar between games. Probably you have a strategy, your opponent has a strategy, and your strategy against the specific other deck you're playing. It's not that there isn't some familiarity and some, yes, eventually the more games you play against the same deck, the more you will start to understand the gameplay, and the variance will lessen to a certain extent. Not zero, you shuffle the deck. But the flux we're talking about is a little larger than that. And the idea is that most games, what options that are available to you, even though there might be some randomization in those options, is a locked thing. For example, if I'm playing Scrabble, look, I can pull different letters, but there's only so many of each letter that I can pull. Once I've pulled all of the L's, no more L's are going to come out. And that as you get really serious about a game, you start tracking things like that. You start figuring out what exists, what's left. And that, when you first start a game and you're more casual about the game, you don't spend the time and energy understanding all the information. In fact, one of the things when you first start playing is you kind of are very in the moment. Like when you start playing Magic, beginning Magic players are like, what can I do this turn? They're not thinking about next turn. Like as you get more advanced, you're like, oh, well, let me think what my opponent will do next turn, because their actions might dictate what I want to do in my turn. And as you get really good, maybe I have a card in my hand that says, oh, knowing my strategy and their strategy, this card's the route to victory. So I need to start setting up things now that won't pay off for 6, 7, 8 turns, but it'll help me win the game. That's very advanced. But in any game, as you get more advanced, part of what happens is you start having to absorb what is all the information I can learn and know. And when you're playing Scrabble, probably at a low level, you're not worried about what letters have been pulled from the bag. But when you're playing at a high level, that is something you think about. That you have to sort of go, what information do I have and how do I maximize that information? And Magic has lots of that. Like a lot of high-end Magic play comes from me understanding what my deck is and what strategies it has and what tools it has, and then what I'm playing against and what their strategy is and what strengths my deck has against their deck. So the reason that is important is at some point, as you get more knowledgeable about a game, you start absorbing more and more information. You track more and more things. To the point where, in theory, you're tracking as many things as can be tracked. Now, there are some games where that becomes beyond the human brain to track. You know, one of the reasons chess is a very fun game is, while there is only so many, you know, your opponent can only make 16 moves on their next turn, assuming no pieces have been captured. Once you start extrapolating 2, 3, 4 turns, the amount of combinations of moves they can make is probably more than most people can map. Now, really good chess players have shorthands to understand, and you recognize strategies, and so there's a lot of shorthanding that happens in advanced play where you can learn how to eradicate the noise, as they say. Well, yes, there's all these moves they could make, but only these moves that make sense, only these moves that would help them win. So I can ignore these moves that won't help them win. So I have less information that I can look at, and it allows me to sort of granularly understand what I'm looking at. Okay, but Magic goes a step beyond that. And the idea there is the mere components, the mere strategy. For example, before Alliances came out, for a long time in Magic, it was true that if your opponent was tapped out, they couldn't cast a spell. So if my opponent had no mana available, I knew that I wasn't going to be interfered with. I wasn't going to have a counterspell. No one's going to destroy my things. Like, I knew that for that turn, till they untapped, there's nothing they could do. In fact, it's kind of funny. I used to do a puzzle column for the Duelist called Magic the Puzzling. And at one point, I made a book. I made a book of Magic puzzles. And one of my editors was a guy named Chris Page, who is a Magic designer. He is part of the East Coast Playtesters. And Chris noticed that I always tapped out my opponent just because I wanted it to sort of be absolute, like, hey, you know when you're doing your puzzle, your opponent won't mess with you, right? This inspired Chris to make the pitch cards and Alliances. The pitch cards are cards, Force of Will being the most famous, where instead of paying the mana cost, you can pitch or discard another card of the same color. Some of them, like Force of Will, also require a life payment. Force of Will, you pay one life in addition. But the idea essentially is, Chris was taking this given, if you are tapped out, you cannot do anything, and saying, well, that doesn't have to be true. And at the time, I've told the story when I talked about Alliances, customer service was really freaked out by the pitch cards. They thought we were breaking a rule we shouldn't break, that was an absolute of Magic. But that's one of the cool things about Magic is it can kind of keep breaking its rules. And, before pitch cards existed, that was a hard and fast rule. If your opponent was tapped out, you knew they couldn't do anything. And all of a sudden, not true. And that is what we talk about by flux, where you can learn something can be true, but all of a sudden, Magic can turn that on its ear. And that one of the things that is... So let's get a little into R&D. So obviously, we make changes. The game changes. It evolves. My example here, I'll use the color pie as an example. The actual philosophies of the color pie have not changed since early days of Magic. What white means. But what does shift over time is our execution of the philosophies through mechanics. For example, for a long time, white and red were not good at drawing cards. We were playing into different weaknesses. And then along comes Commander, which is a little more, the games last longer. And that card drawing just became really important. And Commander ended up becoming the number one played tabletop format, right? So we had to go look at red and look at white and say, okay, we think for the game health, for where the game is at right now, we need red and white to have some card drawing. How do we do that? We came up with the idea of impulsive draw for red. Okay, red gets card drawing, but it's impulsive, right? That you have to use it now. So the idea is that certain styles of gameplay will be good for red, but other kind of things where you're planning ahead, which isn't red specialty, aren't that good. And so it allowed red to draw in a way that leaned into what it did, but didn't give it things that it didn't. It didn't shore up its weaknesses. Likewise, for white, we made the strategy we called sort of long draw, meaning that white can do stuff in set of situations where it gets a card, but only one card per turn. So the idea is it's not getting a lot of cards at once, but if it creates a strategy, if it can set the tone of what's going on, if it can make a structure that it controls, it can get advantage over time. So it sort of draws cards, but not quickly like blue can. over long periods of time. And so things change, things evolve, and that the color pie, that is part of the nature, is things happen, and then we adapt to them. And Commander is a great example, where Commander was not a format Wizards made. It was a format made by some players in Alaska, I believe. And then Sheldon Menery played with them, and then took it and really sort of spread the gospel of the joy of Commander. And it started gaining some popularity. We made a product for it. And then that sort of, you know, fueled the flames. And now it's the number one played tabletop format. But its existence then changed things about Magic, right? So then we adapted the color pie. We adapted how we make sets. We adapted mechanics. Okay, so now they can get into the idea. Explaining that Magic changes, that things are not the same, that something that might have been true 20 years ago just isn't true today. You know, once upon a time, there was a Magic front and a Magic back, and all cards had Magic backs. And then one day we made double-faced cards, and that wasn't true. Okay, so how exactly does Flux happen? And that's, here's where I think there's some, R&D is in charge of experimentation, meaning it is our job to push boundaries and find new space. Much like Chris Page said, oh, well, what if you could cast cards when things were tapped? One of the things that we always do on every set we make is there's a certain amount of bringing things back, right? Certain amount of, oh, here, you know, we're doing this cool theme and here's something we've already done and that fits our theme. We should bring that back. But there always is a little bit of something new. Okay, I want you to care about something that maybe you haven't cared about before. Maybe you care about it in ways you haven't cared about before. Or maybe we have themes that blend in a way that you've never seen them blend before. That we are always trying to find something new. And that new can be on many levels. It could be an individual card. It could be a cycle. It could be a theme. It could be a mechanic. It could be an entire sort of structure for a set. There's lots of things we can do. And part of my job and the job of all the designers is to do that experimentation. We, in fact, have exploratory design, where we really push boundaries and try things and go, okay. And you know, one of the things we try a lot in exploratory design is say, okay, let's try some real out there things. Let's try something, you know, and that sometimes things that at first blush seem like we'd never do that, you know, like when, I remember when Tom Lapillia brought double-faced cards for the first time, we were trying to make werewolves work in original Innistrad. And my first thought was like, okay, you know, maybe that's a bit too far. But, you know, I'm like, okay, but we're trying things. We should experiment with it. And we played with it, and it was really fun. And I'm like, okay, you know. And then I realized the reason we looked at it in the first place was another game we make, Duel Masters, had done double-faced cards. We're like, well, we know we can print them. You know, are they fun? Would Magic like them? And so it is R&D's job to sort of push the boundaries of experiment and try new things. But it is not that experimentation that really determines the Flux. A little bit. I mean, there's a little bit. Chris Page making pitch cards changed Magic in a certain way. But, and this is sort of the big thing about today, we are just making things because essentially we're trying to see, does this add something fun to Magic? Now, we do a lot of playtesting. And so if we playtest and discover we don't think it's fun, we won't put it in the product. So obviously, there's a certain bar we're trying to hit, meaning if we print something, we think it's fun enough to print. Now, that doesn't mean we don't push boundaries. Like, there are certain things that we can't test. There are certain things that we, playtesting at Wizards, cannot know. For example, one of the big things about something is how much does the audience accept something? We will try things. So, like, we do market research, right? And we ask people, we have them rate the mechanics, and they rate it on a scale of 5. Oh, is it 5 or is it 7? No, it must be 7. It must be out of 7, because I know there's things above 5. So we have them rank it. I think it's out of a scale of 7. And basically, it's like, this is amazing. This is, you know, unplayable. Where do you find it? And then we sort of get ratings on how people feel about things, right? And so we can get data on, did people like it? Now, there's a lot of hard, crunchy data. We're literally asking people in the rating. And then there's sort of what I'll call anecdotal data, sort of soft data, where, hey, I have a blog. People will write to me. I can look at social media. Like, when I can get a general sense of whether the audience likes something by kind of watching people talk about it. You got to be careful. Extreme opinions are a little bit louder, meaning when we made double-faced cards, as my example, there were people that really, really disliked them, much like the people that disliked the pitch cards. Whenever we push boundaries, you get a stronger reaction because you're sort of breaking a rule. And a lot of people are like, oh, I've gotten comfortable. I consider this to be a known quantity. And so when you disrupt the apple cart, there are people that are like, I liked my apple cart. What are you doing? But you sort of watch over time and see how people, you know, how it goes with people, and that we can monitor things over time. But the true thing, and this is the big point of today, is R&D fundamentally makes choices of what to try. But as far as what becomes regular business, what becomes something we do again, has a lot to do with the reception of what we did the first time. Meaning we will try things, and there's a scale from I absolutely adore this, I love it, I want you to do it as much as you can, to I hate this with a burning passion, don't you ever do this again. And no matter what we do, there's people at all ends of the scale. Literally, there's no mechanic we can make that somebody doesn't adore and someone doesn't hate. But it's not a matter of one individual. It's a matter of the group. And that's a big point of today is, the way I like to think of it is, there is all of magic players make what I'll call the consciousness. That it's sort of a unified sense of what magic players as a whole want. And the consciousness is what determines whether or not we do more of something. It doesn't determine whether we do it in the first place, although the more something's successful, the more we play in that space. Meaning, when double-faced cards were popular, when we put them out for Innistrad, which were, you know, transforming double-faced cards, that encouraged us to try modal double-faced cards. If transforming double-faced cards had not been popular, we might not have ever tried modal double-faced cards. So, I do think the consciousness can influence even new design, but on some level, our job is to try things, is to test things, is to sort of see what people like. And then the consciousness judges them. The consciousness says what it likes and doesn't like. And I know as a designer, I've tried to go up against the consciousness. For example, my story is two things. First was walls. I'm not a fan of walls. Not that I dislike their gameplay. They're fine. I have no problem with Defender. I just think the idea that this is a creature. It's a living, breathing creature. Oh, what is the living, breathing creature? It's a wall made of stone. What? Like, you know, and I get the flavor of walls in the sense that, you know, we want the idea that I set things up and they protect me, but they don't attack. Like, I understand how Richard got to making them creatures, but it always irked me a little bit in that, you know, from a flavor standpoint, like, we could make artifacts or something. Like, we can make other cards maybe that have a similar function that aren't creatures, you know. And so I tried to stop making walls. I definitely sort of pushed my influence, and I tried to encourage. And Brittany Downermuth, who was a creative director at the time, agreed with me. He didn't think walls creatively were that great. So we stopped doing walls for a while. But then you know what happened? People missed the walls. We kept getting feedback, where are the walls? I want my walls. Walls are cool. And so we eventually brought walls back. There was enough pressure from the players that, like, we couldn't keep walls away. Same with Merfolk. Brady tried to stop Merfolk. Brady's like, well, they're water-based creatures. We're a land-based game. It's kind of odd. And so for a while, we didn't do Merfolk. And then, basically, the consciousness were like, we want Merfolk. And that is the interesting thing. The consciousness is not any one player. It is just a general sense of what the players as a whole enjoy. And then the consciousness is what dictates whether or not we do something. Meaning we'll make a mechanic, we will see what the consciousness thinks. How generally is this? And the more favorable the consciousness of it, the more, you know, if something is really beloved, maybe we do it more often. Maybe it becomes deciduous. Maybe it becomes evergreen. You know, like Scry started as... Aaron Forsythe making mechanics, they thought it was a little spiky. that helped you with card selection. And it sort of was popular enough that we sort of brought it back. We started using it more. And then we realized it was so popular, we just made it evergreen. It was a good tool. Now, there's some influence, you know, whether something is evergreen or deciduous also has, I mean, R&D does have some of influence in that how useful is it? Meaning, the audience might love something. If it's not useful, it's hard to use as much as if it's very useful. Things that are practical get used more. So there is some utility that affects things. It's not, but the consciousness really figures out whether they like it or they don't like it. And if the consciousness likes it, you'll see more like it. If the consciousness hates it, you will see less. Now, every once in a while, we make something, the consciousness doesn't like it, and we realize, oh, maybe we did it wrong. You know, the classic there is Chroma brought back his devotion. Chroma was what I thought was a really neat idea. It just didn't go over well with the players. But then we're like, well, maybe we did it bad. Maybe our execution was bad. We tried it again, and we made devotion. And that time, it went over great. Which is another interesting note about the consciousness, which is execution matters. That is not just a matter of, you know, the consciousness doesn't understand conceptually if it likes the idea. Either it likes what we made or it doesn't like what we made. And that part of our job in R&D sometimes is to figure out when it doesn't like it, why doesn't it like it? And that is in, like, I would say a big part of my job is reading the consciousness, is understanding the consciousness. And like I said, some of that is hard and fast data. But a lot of that also is just sort of interacting with the audience and getting a sense. Like, for example, when we put something out, I pay a lot of attention to what excites people. What do people talk about? You know, what are people drawn to? And that a lot of my job as head designer is I've been absorbing the consciousness for years. For 30 years, I've been absorbing the consciousness. And I've gotten pretty good at it. Like, I have a pretty good sense of understanding what players like and don't like. Just because when something comes out, I communicate with the players, and I've learned over time, you know, how they communicate when they generally like something. And so a lot of when I'm plotting out the future, when we're making mechanics or making sets, I'm always sort of keeping the eye on, okay, are we leaning into things that we think they'll like? And some of it's hypothetical. That's the other big thing for R&D is a lot of what we're doing is not necessarily known. Some of it is. Sometimes we're extrapolating, and then we're playing in known space. But sometimes we're really playing in sort of unknown space. But we still can use our knowledge of the consciousness to extrapolate what we think will be. The reason for my talk today about the flux is trying to explain that I think there's a lot of people like to get mad at wizards because we make decisions, because we do things. And I mean, obviously, the makers of the game, are making decisions. My point today, though, is while we make the decisions, it is based on the consciousness of you, the players. That it's based on what all the players together as an entity enjoy and like. And that, by the way, is something really interesting. My former life, I was a writer. And there's something about writing. Now, there are things, like I worked on a sitcom where, yes, I would write lines, but other people would edit them, right? Where there's a whole group trying to find the best joke for something. So that's writing. Like, writing isn't always solitary, but I've done plenty of solitary writing where I'm writing my thing. And there's something really interesting about a game where, like, I'm used to when I'm writing my story or whatever, I, the author, have a lot of control. But Magic's interesting because it's this ever-evolving, changing thing that I'm very beholden to understanding the general consciousness. And that it is not... So, for example, Universes Beyond, another touchy topic among some people. That is a good example of exactly how a process will work. We come up with an idea. Aaron came up with the Universes Beyond. Although, once again, if you even go back to stuff like the Arc system, the idea of having other properties intermingle is something we've talked about forever. I think Aaron recognized that it was time that we could do it. But the idea is we started small. We started just doing a little tiny bit. You know, we did the Godzilla skins. We did, like, we started small. And we sort of watched to see what would happen. Either players would embrace it or players wouldn't. And I guarantee you, if we had done a first, our first forays into Universes Beyond was not well received. Now, be aware, I'm not, and this is important, there's a difference between the consciousness and just loudness on the internet. For example, when we introduced Universes Beyond, the first product that Universes Beyond was Walking Dead, Secret Lair Walking Dead. There are a lot of people that are very vocal about it. Once again, people don't like change, and especially when you change something fundamental. And Walking Dead did two big things that people really, really had issues with. One was Universes Beyond, and the second was we were making unique content through Secret Lair. So there was a lot of response, but when we actually looked, it was the top-selling Secret Lair of all time. When we did market research on it, people were excited for it. You know, as we dipped our toe into Universes Beyond, what we discovered was the consciousness liked it a lot. And the point is, kind of where magic steers is a lot on the consciousness. If the general magic consciousness likes something, and they have really liked Universes Beyond. I'm not saying there's not a vocal minority. I'm not saying there's not people complaining about it. But if you look at the actual, all the feedback and all the you know, all the metrics, players really like Universes Beyond. As a whole, there are individuals that don't, and that is always true. Once again, the flux is not based on individual decisions. It is based on group decisions, on the group feelings, on the consciousness. And as people like things, they grow. As Commander became more popular, it grew. That affected things. And that is a big part of flux is, like, one of the things that to me is very interesting is, on some level, the game becomes the thing the players most want it to be. That is the most amazing thing about flux, is that Magic keeps evolving what it is. But it doesn't evolve randomly. It doesn't evolve because R&D just does things. It evolves because the players, like, on some level, I like to think of this as survival of the fittest, right? We make mechanics and we do things, but only the strong survive. Only the mechanics that the consciousness likes is what thrives. And so we put things out there, we try new things, but some of them do not survive and they die off and not to be seen again. While others thrive and duplicate, you know, and that is what is going on. That is what flux means. Flux means that you, the players, as a whole, as a consciousness, the game becomes what you want it to be. It's not what R&D chooses it to be, not what Wizards chooses it to be. It's not what any one player chooses it to be. It's a conglomeration. It's the consciousness. And that is something that is really neat to me. The idea that there's this game that becomes what its players want it to be is fascinating from a game design standpoint. And I understand that I'm there, like, my job is to understand what the consciousness wants and try to make more. That's my job, is to try to read the consciousness, understand what they like, and try to make new things that they might like. And then, I mean, another thing that's fascinating, another reason my job doesn't get boring is, I try new things, and some things I think you will like, you do. Some things I really like, you don't. Although, having done this a long time, I'm getting better at sort of recognizing what the consciousness likes. It's one of the things that it's a good skill I have. I think I can see the consciousness farther out than most people. Just because my job is to sort of find the unknown. And so I've trained a lot of my skills to sort of figure out whether the unknown is something people will like. Or to figure out what is, it doesn't exist yet, but the consciousness might like. So, but anyway, guys, that is flux. That is a core aspect of Magic. Something that makes Magic very unique and different from most other games. It is a game that is constantly living and breathing. It is a game that is constantly adapting. And it is not just adapting willy-nilly. It is not adapting just because of R&D whims. It is adapting because you, the players, in together as a consciousness, are dictating what the game is. And that, you know, we will give you things to test out what you like. But in the end, it is really what the consciousness wants that drives the game. And that, my friends, that is what Flux is. And that's really exciting. You know, there's a lot of things that I enjoy about magic. But this idea of magic being this thing that responds to its players is really cool. And that's why I decided to talk about it today. But anyway, guys, I am now at work. So we all know what that means. It means this is my end of my drive to work. So instead of talking magic, it's time for me to be making magic. So I will see you all next time. Bye-bye.